Hello and welcome to the latest in Innovation Forum's webinar series. I'm Ian Welsh. Today we'll be focusing on deforestation and looking at how companies are developing zero deforestation commitments and accelerating their implementation. While there are certainly a lot of commitments around, actual progress towards achieving these goals remains, by and large, slow. Translating commitments into actual practice on the ground in palm oil, in soy, timber, pulp and paper, and cattle product supply chains is a highly complex matter. Collaboration is increasingly regarded as the only practical route to success and to progress, involving business, the NGO community, financial institutions, and government. And everyone can do more to push the pace of commitment implementation. We have a packed panel of experts to lead our discussion this afternoon. We have Tom Bregman, Project Manager at Forest 500 with the Global Canopy Programme. We have Gillian Gladstone, Senior Manager Forests at CDP. Sylvain Aguard, Corporate Social Responsibility at BNP Paribas. Samuel Mary, Senior Sustainability Research Analyst with Kepler Chevreux. And Fiona Wheatley, Sustainable Development Manager with Marks & Spencer. And my thanks to Global Canopy Programme for sponsoring this webinar and my Innovation Forum colleague, Charlene Ordonez, for convening our panel and organising this afternoon. The issues we'll be covering today will form part of the discussion at the next in our series of conferences focusing on deforestation and business at the Pew Center in Washington, D.C. in April. However, right back to today, I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to help frame our discussion. We will then move into a period of Q&A in the second half of our hour. Now, we want the session to be as interactive as possible, so please do submit your questions using the comments box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. If you can keep your questions short, they're much more likely to be used. I should point out that there will be no slides. This is a structured panel discussion throughout, and we are recording the webinar, and we'll circulate a link to the recording in the next couple of days. Now, as we have a large panel, I've asked that they keep their opening comments to no more than 5 minutes, and I will be strict if you go over time. So, turning to Tom from GCP. Tom, you are one of the writers of Global Canopy Programme's new report, Sleeping Giants of Deforestation, the Companies, Countries and Financial Institutions with the Power to Save Forests. So, who are the companies and organisations with the power to save forests, and why do they have that power? Tom, over to you.
Thank you, Ian. The report that you mentioned was written using information collected by the team as part of the Global Canopy Programme's Forest 500. For those attendees unfamiliar with the Forest 500, it's a project that objectively identifies the ranks and tracks 500 actors that have the power to virtually end global deforestation. The 500 power brokers identified includes companies involved in agricultural supply chains, with total revenues exceeding $4.5 trillion, 150 financial institutions that hold $2.8 trillion in finance in these companies, and 50 jurisdictions, including 25 commodity-producing countries, that accounts for 85% of tropical and subtropical forest cover. Once identified, these companies, financial institutions and countries are ranked according to the policies that they have in place to disentangle themselves from deforestation associated with the production of a handful of commodities that have driven around two-thirds of tropical deforestation over the last decade. Last week, we launched the third annual rankings, and the key finding of that was that despite signs of improvement among leading companies, the rate of progress by most is inadequate to achieve 2020 or 2030 goals. Now, the headline seems somewhat negative, so I'm going to start with the positives. Progress is being made. In particular, the leaders continue to develop their policies and improve existing deforestation policies. For example, in the last year, 11% of the 250 companies that we assessed moved up a Forest 500 score band due to a newly established deforestation policy or an improvement in an existing one. And in particular, credit should go to Colgate, Marks & Spencer and Orkla for strengthening their policies on deforestation. These companies now join the ranks of Danone, Unilever, Nestlé and others by scoring 5 points out of five in the Forest 500. But what is becoming clear in your introduction, Ian, is that the actions of these leaders is actually not enough. Deforestation is still occurring, and we recently found out that rates of deforestation in the Amazon are the highest since 2008. Now, this isn't necessarily surprising, given that the vast majority of companies that produce or procure these commodities still actually lack policies to stop the loss of tropical forests. In fact, 57% of companies assessed in the Forest 500 score 2 points or less. This means that they are lacking a critical policy component. Either they do not cover all the commodities they're involved with, or their policies only apply to specific regions. Furthermore, key commodity supply chains are still not adequately covered. For example, only 26% of companies operating in the cattle supply chain have a policy to address environmental impacts from the production, trade, and sourcing of cattle products. And what is even more concerning is that there is also a lack of improvement amongst these companies in the cattle supply chain. And over the last 2 years, there hasn't been an increase in the number of companies that have policies that disentangle their production or procurement of cattle products from the loss of intact primary or conservation value forests. So, how do we change this? In short, I think we need a shift in market signals that show that deforestation is no longer acceptable. And there have been a number of deforestation commitments by leading downstream companies over the last few years. And I think these need to continue as they send a very strong message. But one other lever that could help to accelerate the transition to a deforestation-free economy is the finance sector. By engaging with companies in their portfolios, financial institutions could encourage companies to put in place and implement more robust policies on deforestation. And over the past year, there have been a number of encouraging developments. For example, Deutsche Bank have laid out an expectation that companies that they lend to should have their own zero net deforestation commitment. However, despite financial institutions lending or investing large sums to companies operating in agricultural commodity supply chains, and the implications of deforestation for a 1.5 degree world, commodity-driven deforestation does not seem to currently be a mainstream issue for the finance sector. For example, in this year's assessment of financial institution policies, we found that only a quarter had a commodity-specific lending or investment policy. And I think to create stronger market signals for sustainable production, financial institutions need to address deforestation issues associated with all the commodities in which they are investing or lending to, and clearly communicate and engage with companies in their portfolios on the issue. So in summary, I think there's been great progress in development of new policies and improvement of existing policies this year. And many leading companies are beginning to implement these. But I think more needs to be done by companies and the financial institutions associated with them to encourage the laggards to produce and procure commodities without an impact on global forests.
Thanks very much. Just a quick question from me, but it does seem, it strikes me that it's still the same old names that you're mentioning in terms of the leaders. Is that the impression that you get too?
I think you're correct. The leaders are still leading, and naturally it's easy to say that the leaders are still at the top, but actually I think the leaders are actually doing a lot sending the messages downstream. But also, I think they're beginning to work through their policies to their suppliers. And I think this is really critical. And I think the role that the leaders play is helping to encourage those that are lagging behind to actually step up and remove deforestation from their supply chains as well.
Great. Well, Tom, thank you very much indeed. Gillian from CDP, turning to you. CDP has also just released a report, Revenue at Risk, Why Addressing Deforestation is Critical to Business Success. And you find that $906 billion of annual turnover for publicly listed companies is at risk from deforestation. So that's a big number. So what should these companies be doing more of?
Thanks so much, Ian, for having me on the webinar. As you said, last week we here at CDP launched our 2016 Global Forest Report. The report is entitled Revenue at Risk, Why Addressing Deforestation is Critical to Business Success. And this is based on the disclosures of 187 companies on the risks and opportunities linked to the four commodities responsible for the majority of tropical deforestation. The report explores whether companies are sufficiently engaged across their supply chains to meet their future business needs and protect long-term value. And our analysis looks at corporate deforestation risk management activities in light of shifting regulatory and investor expectations. We're seeing growing investor interest in companies' actions to remove deforestation from their supply chains. The number of investors requesting deforestation data through CDP is up by a fifth from last year to 365 investor signatories, with some $22 trillion in assets under management. And this represents a six-fold increase since the inception of our work on forests in 2009. I will run through a few of the findings from the report, but please do take a look at the report yourself. You can find it on our website at www.cdp.net. The report found, as you said, Ian, a substantial share of corporate income depends on commodities linked to deforestation risk. Companies report that on average a quarter of their revenue, or $906 billion in annual turnover, depends on these commodities linked to deforestation. And this is based on data reported directly to CDP by these disclosing companies. In addition, we found that while there's corporate confidence around the sustainable future supply of commodities, that confidence actually may be misplaced. Companies are overlooking how deforestation-related risks will impact their growth. We found that 81% of companies who are agricultural producers, those producing the commodities that are fed down global supply chains, have felt impacts that have resulted in substantive changes to their business in the past 5 years. And we found that fewer than half have evaluated the availability or quality of key forest risk commodities over the medium term. And really what we're seeing is a domino effect down supply chains. Where unsustainable commodities enter at the top of a supply chain, the effects ricochet all the way downstream. Failing to address deforestation then also impacts reputation, as companies risk not only increased regulatory scrutiny, but a whole range of other impacts, including potential consumer boycotts, community opposition, product suspension, etc. So it's clear that companies must engage with their supply chain in order to minimize risk and capitalize on business opportunities. 94% of manufacturers and retailers that work with their suppliers have identified supply chain related opportunities. This compares with only 35% for those that do not. So, in order to ensure sustainable future growth, companies must move deforestation risk management into the boardroom and also embed it into their business strategies. There's a clear business case for this. Companies that have board-level oversight of deforestation risk management identify 19% more opportunities than those that do not. So, in order to assess and manage risk across the supply chain, companies must begin by asking their suppliers to disclose information about the risks and opportunities they face. And to this end, CDP launched, alongside our report last week, the integration of forests into our existing supply chain data sharing program. Additionally, developing supply chain performance plans will help companies turn their commitments into clear and strong procurement standards, communicating expectations, tracking progress, collaborating, and undertaking a review process. So it's clear from our work that ending deforestation is not only good for forests, but also good for business. And now it's time for companies to take some of these steps to really embed this work into what they're doing.
Thank you, Gillian. You mentioned right at the start of your comments how companies are having to engage in a kind of shifting regulatory environment. How do you think things are going to change with the changeover in the White House and the U.S. administration in early 2017? What's your view on how things are going to change relating to the sort of deforestation and commodity framework at the moment? How things are going to be changing?
That's a tough question. It's still the very early days here gaining insight into what this new administration will mean for companies in the U.S. and those with supply chains and investors in the U.S. So it's hard to tell exactly what the impact will be, but we do know that business has a strong role in tackling deforestation and, you know, potential to fill the gap when policies are not forthcoming. So, you know, we're not underestimating the power of business and the momentum that's already underway here in the States to move forward regardless of what the regulatory environment brings.
Okay, thank you. Perhaps a difficult question to lob to you for the first off. I guess, you know, we will see companies be filling the gaps. I guess that's probably the way things are going to proceed. Thanks very much, Julian. Can I turn to Sylvain from BNP Paribas? BNP has been a member of the Banking Environment Initiative for the past year or so. So given this, what is your deforestation focus at BNP, and what do you and your colleagues expect from well-performing companies now?
Yes, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having us in this webinar. So I'm Sylvain Goyard. I work in the corporate social responsibility team of BNP Paribas CIB. So basically, what our team does is environmental and social risk management. So BNP Paribas CIB is a large international bank with an important footprint in different all the continents and in different sectors. We mostly deal with large corporates, which include large commodity producers and traders, as well as and users of these commodities. Absolutely. I mean, we took quite some strong commitments regarding no deforestation, and I think this dates back to 2011 when we started to develop two important policies that we still have on wood pulp and on palm oil. Since then, we've developed a sector policy on the agriculture sector, which cover also the other commodities that are covered by the Forest 500 report, so namely soy, cattle, and timber. Important, I think, to say it's part of a global commitment that the bank has on CSR, and we think it's really an important differentiating factor both for us and for our clients. And we are lucky to have a management which is quite committed to ensuring we do a proper job and that we act responsibly in our day-to-day operations. We signed up with the Soft Community Compact in 2014, and really the way we operationalize that is by implementing our CSR policies. To give you maybe some of the things we require from our clients on the environmental and social side, so palm oil, wood pulp, and agriculture, we ask our clients to have a high conservation value policy that applies to the new development. We have a wide range of social requirements as well, but it's not really the point of this webinar. Although it's linked, I mean, deforestation cannot be sold out, and it includes a strong social component. We also ask our clients if they put in place if they have a high carbon stock analysis when they develop new plantations. And it's really something that we are closely following the development of these methodologies. Just to be cognizant of time, I think you said very very interesting things at the very beginning of your introduction when you said that collaboration is important. I think it's critical for us, and we saw that to deliver actual value on the ground, we need to partner really with our companies. It cannot just be a banking relationship. It needs to go to another level. And when we are able to bring in NGOs, which are reputed and who have a good reputation, we really can help our clients to improve their operations, and that can also improve the business relationship we have with them. So it's really something where we see a win-win situation. Fully agree as well with the comment made by Tom from the GCP in that we feel sometimes a bit alone or singled out, you know, on potential transactions, you know, when other banks do not have the same requirements regarding our clients. Sometimes we may lose business because of that, and we feel that we lack a kind of platform where we can exchange practices and make sure that we can bring change more quickly, because I think it's good to be that BNP Paribas is part of the three top banks in the Forest 500 support, but we feel that there is still a lot to be done. So I think that's pretty much it. I think for that, then we can answer questions later.
Yeah. Thanks very much indeed. Just coming back to something you said at the end there, you're saying that you get frustrated and your colleagues get frustrated because you feel that you're asking for more than other banks are. Do you sense then that properly engaging with deforestation issues is still very much in the SRI community and is not a mainstream concern at the moment?
To be honest, I'm not really on the investment part of the bank of BNP Paribas. We are really on the financing part. But yeah, I think banks do ask questions. We find that often it's the case when there is, for instance, you know, a controversy or a civil society campaign against a company. And it may not be very systematic. So I think we need to be. I mean, banks generally speaking, the financial sector can be more systematic, I guess, in how they approach clients on this, and that, so to be more proactive rather than reactive to criticism. I think that's
sure. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much indeed, Samuel from Kepler Cheuvreux. Your organization is present in 13 major financial centers. So I'm wondering, with this global perspective, how do you want to see companies engaging in deforestation a bit more?
Yeah, good afternoon, Jan. Thanks much for your invitation and this question, actually, that will enable me to walk you through some of the findings of a recent research report. So my name is Samuel Mary. I'm part of the ESG and sustainability research team at Kepler Cheuvreux, which is indeed an equity brokerage company. I'm basically in charge of our thematic and impact investing research, and I published a report earlier this year that tackles the topic of forest and land degradation and the underlying investment risk and opportunities, focusing on large European companies that are publicly listed. So today I would like to walk you through a couple of key takeaways regarding the business case for deforestation and more sustainable landscapes from the perspective of analyzing the risk return profile of investments or stocks, which basically helps shed light on the investor's perspective on the topic of today. I will outline these findings in three steps or three parts. The first one is about the drivers of rising investors' attention, so basically the forces that make this topic increasingly important in our view. The second one is our framework to look at the investment risk and opportunities and our sort of response to this changing landscape. And the third one is our recommendations in terms of corporate reporting and strategy and the sort of indicators, conceptual boundaries, and the approach taken by some companies as we think cater to financial markets needs. So if we start with the first point, the drivers of investors' attention, if we take a step back, forest and land degradation as an investment risk theme has been arguably lagging behind other environmental topics such as carbon or water, which benefited from more attention. However, we think a range of drivers help this issue catching up and gathering traction in capital markets. And many of these drivers unfolded over the past 18 months in particular. And there is one overarching development that we think is of interest, which is a growing recognition of actually the linkages in interdependence between environmental issues and basically climate change on the one hand and natural capital issues on the other hand. And this has gained significance in the context of the landscape approach ramp up and basically the holistic perspective to tackle these issues simultaneously. So if we do an analogy with climate change and what has been required to take climate change to the next level and make it a very mainstream concern for financial markets, there are basically three things. The first one is about the economic case. And we think there are more robust findings regarding the macro trends associated with deforestation. That's been particularly manifest in the context of studies on the ecosystem services value, which is at risk or threatened by unsustainable trends. And there is a number of interesting studies, including from the economics of land degradation, that put a quantitative data on the importance of this threat. And we also highlight the importance of the work of some related bodies, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, a sort of IPCC for these issues, and that help enhance scientific findings and ultimately drive bolder government actions on some of these issues. In terms of policy trends, the New York Declaration on Forests was obviously an important catalyst, but over the past 12 months, we have had two major international summits that helped mobilize action around deforestation and the underlying issues such as biodiversity loss or land degradation. And I'm referring mainly to the Sustainable Development Goals and the one named 15, the Life on Land, which was a key milestone. And I'm also referring, obviously, to the Paris Agreement and the COP21 2-degree objective that places an emphasis as well as part of the country's low carbon pledges on deforestation. So we are seeing encouraging trends, policy trends in this respect. And if we look at capital markets, there are also major events and disasters that basically occurred over the past year and that are related to the theme of today, such as BHP Billiton's San Marco Dam burst in Brazil, or the Indonesian forest fires, or the El Nino phenomenon, which basically helps to understand the physical risk linked to the story, and that is the rise of extreme weather events and the impact on commodities prices. And we are seeing more and more issues and controversies of this type just over the past few days, looking at the main financial news about OLAM and then the underlying controversy related to Africa or Jirajara Wali Group. So there is an interesting momentum there. So that's the backdrop. What we have done against this backdrop is basically to develop a framework to map the various types of financial risk and opportunities related to deforestation and land degradation across sectors in order to get a sort of methodological structure and drawing upon the existing and very helpful work of the Global Canopy Program, the CDP, and some other third parties organizations. But we have placed a particular emphasis on the financial risk and opportunity size. And for that purpose, we have basically grouped sectors according to three categories or buckets according to where exactly we think the most relevant financial impact is identified. So that includes the first group comprised of agricultural commodities in the supply chain, so some food and beverages companies or consumer sectors that are basically exposed through mainly the cost or cost of goods sold. In the second group, we have land operators that are exposed through their operations and are facing or could face growing capex or opex associated to these issues. And in the third group, we are looking at companies that are primarily exposed through their products and services on the revenues front. And we think the probably most interesting sector in when looking at this theme is the first bucket, so the ones which are exposed through agricultural commodities, and there are a wide range of risk factors, so that includes commodities prices, obviously, related to physical risk, also liabilities, and as well as the top-line growth on the back of solutions, for example, certified products, and the reputational and customer demand for this sort of products. So we think it is important to categorize this risk and to look into the sourcing challenges which are of particular interest. However, we also think that the key challenge is to move beyond an assessment of what are companies' exposure to these issues or this risk to the actual financial risk. And this can differ significantly if we move from theoretical exposure to actual risk. If we look, for example, at the El Nino phenomenon that occurred last year that drove an increase in commodities prices, one could see it as detrimental to the large food and beverage companies. However, when we conducted our analysis and scenario analysis in depth, we found out that some companies could benefit should they be able to pass on raw material cost increase. And there are also discrepancies between what will occur in the short and long run. Some might benefit in the short run and not in the long run. So these sort of nuances and differences are all part of this complex picture in order to estimate the extent to which companies can eventually get financially affected by these issues, and the fact that this impact has to be articulated and taken into consideration in light of the business context of these companies. So then the third point, which is basically our recommendations in terms of corporate reporting and strategy, what we think are the interesting trends and developments there. So we have reviewed over 40 companies as part of our work, and essentially we find on the whole that the practical targets deployed by companies, as reflected in the latest GCP and CDP's reports, they vary significantly but often lack clarity and generally mean only a mere step up of traceability systems and some vague procurement standards. What we think is perhaps more of interest is to get or take a look at the number of companies that are being a bit more articulate and are setting some more detailed definition, and that's an important development, but we are still witnessing some companies disclosing some sustainability plan with some sort of 100% sustainable ingredients in the products, but without explicitly mentioning to investors what are the underlying products or costs impact associated with these targets. So the answer is that we also observe that a number of companies' policies are not robust enough to move towards zero net deforestation, but we are seeing some encouraging trends. And there are basically two broad recommendations we would like to make, and perhaps that could be a conclusion, which is the importance of having a reporting from companies which is making a clear distinction between the financial impact and the sort of business context on the one hand, and the environmental and social impact on the other hand, because they both demand different metrics, they revolve around different challenges, and they can overlap or be interrelated, but in practice, they are actually they differ in practice more often. An important development in this respect is the launch of the Natural Capital Protocol that was launched over the summer, that basically sets out some guidelines for corporates reporting on this issue. And there is another important recommendation that we could make, which is around the specificity or the fact that companies can be a bit more granular in the way they report on these issues. I could highlight companies such as Nestlé or Danone, which are sort of front runners in this respect, in the sense that they do provide some policy elements that are clear enough to send a compelling message. And perhaps in conclusion, I would also continue with this analogy with climate change, and an interesting development to watch in the few days and months will be the work of the task force on financial and climate related financial disclosure, and we think this could be a helpful framework in order as well to better understand how deforestation could be and deforestation reporting could be essentially enhanced to cater to investors' needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Very comprehensive opening comments, Samuel. In the interest of time, I'm going to move straight on to Fiona from Marks and Spencer's. Fiona, perhaps you can give a bit of a corporate perspective on how M&S's deforestation policies are formulated in general, and also incorporating some of what you've heard from the other panelists.
Goodness, that's quite incorporating what I've heard from other panelists could take some time in itself. So I'm going to take quite a top line view on this, particularly in recognition of the fact that we are quite short in time. And I think, you know, the kind of framing question is around accelerating the implementation of zero deforestation commitments. And I think the first question we're going to look at then is what progress has been made. Where are the strengths? Where are the weaknesses? I absolutely do not dispute that immeasurably more progress has to be achieved. I think what we don't always see is the amount of progress that has been made on building the foundations for all different types of sectors, particularly business, but many others as well, to meet these zero deforestation commitments. I mean, I've been involved in this area for 10 years, but I think particularly engaged at a very, very active level for the last 3 years. And the amount of knowledge, insight and understanding that Marks and Spencer has around the risks, the actors, the issues, the challenges, the dynamics, in all commodities. You know, this is a very, very global challenge for us. We're affected by all of these. It's an immeasurable step forward compared to 10 years ago. But it also has to be acknowledged that with each step that we take, we seem to discover new challenges. You know, whether that's from defining a high carbon stock or supporting smallholders in palm oil, to, you know, poor industry engagement in cattle was referred to earlier. I think everyone's extremely concerned about that at the moment. And the reality of undemanding emerging markets, which means that very often those who are working the hardest, doing the most, are commercially disadvantaged because it is easier and cheaper for people to do nothing. And that's a real dilemma at the moment. But nonetheless, even taking these challenges into account, every step that we take, our determination gets stronger. Complexity and scale continue to be major obstacles, and none more so than for retail with our vast product ranges and extremely complex supply chains. But, as I said, determination is maintained, and I see that across our sector as a whole, and I'm very pleased by that. But I think where I'd like to see probably one of the biggest leaps forward is I'd like to see a radical shift in transparency. I'd like to see all actors in the business sector specifically, but as I said, it really does extend beyond this, making clear their policies and their performance. And then we can really accelerate change partly through understanding what works and what doesn't, but also understanding who's working and who's not, who's really putting their shoulder behind the wheel and shifting this agenda, and who's sitting back and waiting for things to change so that they can leap on the bandwagon and catch a lift once all the difficult stuff's done. And by transparency, you know, I am absolutely not just talking about traceability here. I'm talking about transparency of land ownership and concessions, of policies and commitments, of relationships. You know, there is always an element of commercial confidentiality that does constrain absolute transparency. But let's move the agenda from where commercial confidentiality is used as a default position for showing nothing, into the default position being you show everything unless you can justify it on the basis of transparency and commercials. And then volumes, trade flows, and progress against performance and emerging challenges. These are all the things that I would like to see much more open, much more public, and much more using that information to create a shared agenda. But most of all, I think the biggest key in proper transparency to unlock genuine market transformation is absolutely collaboration. Working closer with our competitors, our suppliers, governments, NGOs and finance to make real impact on the ground. We absolutely can make more of a difference. We can do it faster, with less resource, and with greater impact if we do it together. I'm actually really proud of the moves that have been made by the retail sector in the UK and Northern Europe. We've got a very effective collaboration. It has been built over many years. And we're really exploring the role of pre-competitive collaboration. And we don't have all the answers yet, but we're moving into very new and very interesting space. And I really look forward to these models growing in importance in the future and hopefully me coming back and telling you how they have contributed to the change that we're all seeking. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Fiona. I'm just wondering if Fiona, you were slightly breaking up there, and it sounded like you were on a slightly bad line. I hope that we're all able to hear the gist of Fiona's comments. So I certainly was able to, but I wonder if you might consider putting down the phone and dialing back in for the Q&A. It was a little bit unclear to hear you sometimes, and also we got that reaction from some of the people, some of our audience were sending me information saying that they couldn't hear you terribly clearly. Your line was breaking up. So if you are able to, if you're
not.
I just about caught all that you were saying, I think, just about, but if you wouldn't mind perhaps putting the phone down and redialing, I'll bring you back in when we go into the Q&A, if that's okay.
Yep, no problem.
Thanks a lot, Fiona. We'll be back. Right. I would like to now turn to some of the questions from our audience. And first of all, something that in relation to something that Sylvain from BNP Paribas mentioned, Our questioner says, you talked about NGOs, Sylvain, and how they help your clients in their operations. So could you give some examples of the NGOs that you feel are notable in this space and sort of work they are doing with your clients?
Yes, thank you. Actually, to give an example, yes, for instance, in the palm oil sector, we are working with TFT, the Forest Trust. So working with them, you know, they both provide support in development of our policy, of policies, and also in working with clients on the ground to help them to improve their practices, you know. So that's quite a partnership that we found quite useful, and that really can bring you know, some added value for the client as well, because when working with BNP Paribas, they can also benefit from this expertise from TFT, which of course we cannot match. So yeah, that's an example of a good and successful partnership that we have.
And what are the components of a good partnership that are essential for success?
Well, I think, I mean, what can I say? I mean, maybe trust. You know, I think it's generally speaking, I think transparency is important. I mean, we are open to hear any, you know, from both the NGO or the, especially our clients as well. We are open to hear you know, reasons why it may be difficult to put in place a particular you know, no deforestation policy. I think transparency is really key. I mean, we know that putting in place policies, especially when you have to look also not only at your own operations but also at the supply chain, is really challenging, because you also have a strong social component in that. You need to to use reliable data, which is not always easy. You need to deal as well with potentially the government in some cases. So we are open to hear what the challenges are and to work together with the client on how to overcome these hurdles and how to achieve actual progress.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom from Global Canopy Program. Turning to you, from your research, looking at the countries and the institutions with the power to save the forests. How much does the collaboration aspect come into that, and what do you see as the kind of key parts in a collaboration process that are essential?
I think the key opportunity that we have moving forward is really the awakening of the finance sector, and I think touching on Sylvain's point around, you know, things being reactionary historically. We still see that, you know, for palm oil, there are far more commitments for palm oil amongst both companies and financial institutions. So many more of them have policies in place, which is great. And, you know, it is very difficult to assess, you know, the risks in portfolios. But actually, we identified 2.8 trillion of shareholdings, loans and bond holdings in the 250 companies that we look at from 150 financial institutions. And I see each of those financial ties as an opportunity to engage, and it's great to see financial institutions like BNP Paribas taking it on board themselves. And I think it's, you know, more and more financial institutions as they realise the risks and opportunities that face them, face financing companies operating in forest risk commodity supply chains. I think more and more of them will engage with the companies that they hold shares in or lend to.
Great, thanks very much. Fiona Wheatley, you back with us?
I am.
Excellent, thank you very much, and that sounds a much better line. Fiona, we've been talking about NGO partners. For M&S, what have you looked for in NGO partners for collaboration? And you know, what are the key elements of the relationship from M&S's perspective that have meant a successful outcome?
We tend to have more soft partnerships with NGOs. I mean, we do. In saying that, we do have a formal partnership with WWF, but the programs within that aren't focused on commodities. Although I do a lot with the broader team within WWF and commodities. So we really think that the best partnership with NGOs is one of learning and sharing. We believe that NGOs bring an enormous amount of value to debate and discussions in terms of the insights from what happens in the ground. They tend to be the people with the boots on the ground, so they actually see and hear from a very different perspective than, you know, an auditor or a visitor from a company could ever do, another third party. So we seek their advice on what's happening. We also think it's really important that they understand the realities of supply chain relationships and buying practices and procurement kind of conventions, because then only through us collectively having that kind of shared understanding are we ever going to come up with the right models of change. And actually, I think that's been a real challenge in the past that I think we're beginning to make some progress on, is the assumptions that have been made about the what would be classed as the right interventions, and the assumption that these interventions will either be right for every shape of organisation. And I think traceability is a tendency there. There is an assumption and a commonly presented belief that, for example, Marks & Spencer cannot be a responsible retailer unless it knows where everything is grown at a producer level. And my assertion to that is that if we're going to depend on every retail company investing the enormous amount of resource and effort to capture that data, we are never going to get the full effectiveness, leverage and utility from the sector that way. So we need to have that understanding. Someone has to have traceability at some points in the chain, but it doesn't necessarily need to be at a molecular level. The other area is certification. Certification has been an incredible force for change for many years, and it has defined what sustainable production looks like. We are seeing a plateauing of volumes. I mean, in some areas it's quite a high plateau. If you look at something like palm oil, which I believe is about 17% global production, FSC, PEFC is about 10% production, soy much lower, and cattle really doesn't have a certification approach at the moment. But actually, certification on its own is not going to be the full answer. It is really important to have a model that allows for farm engagement, but that itself is, we really risk creating islands of green in an ocean of deforestation and degradation. And we really have to look at what other actions need to take place and by whom, and how we shift the agendas and how we really get that market transformation.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, Fiona. Let's move to the next question we've had in from our audience, something that's come up a number of times actually, and it's looking at a bit more, in a bit more detail, the role of financial institutions in advancing zero deforestation commitments among their clients and in their portfolios, and how financial institutions can be leaders in this regard. Now, Sylvain and Samuel, I'll give you a little bit of time to think about it, but I wondered if I could turn to Gillian from CDP. And perhaps you could give us, Gillian, I see you are muted, but if perhaps you can bring yourself back into the conversation, Gillian, in a second. Tom, I'll turn to you first then. What do you think is the role of financial institutions, and what do you want to see them doing to be leaders?
I mean, covering, you know, the points that I raised earlier and the points raised by the other participants, I think it's clear that, you know, there needs to be more engagement. But as Sylvain picked up, it's very tricky to understand which companies to necessarily prioritise, because the companies are exposed to these commodities and therefore deforestation in very, very different ways. So I think what we need moving forward is some sort of way to standardise or help prioritise engagement. And I think once we begin to prioritise those lists, I think, for financial institutions, it would be great if they were able to use their relationships to ask questions. And earlier this year, we held a workshop with CDP at the PRI offices in London to discuss sort of the next steps for the finance sector. How does the finance sector move beyond the current status quo? And thinking about, you know, what are a set of investor expectations, as it were? What questions should they be asking of companies, and we're currently asking people to contribute to that document. And I think as soon as we begin to, as a community, understand what the key questions are, then I think we can really move the agenda forward.
Thank you, Tom. Gillian, turning to you then, from your perspective, what are the roles of financial institutions and how can they achieve leadership?
Hi, thanks. Yeah, echoing much of what Tom said, you know, there certainly prioritization is really important that investors understand where the, you know, both the financial risk sits for them in their portfolios. You know, as we've seen, and I talked about a little bit before, there's quite significant financial risk, it would seem, and so important that companies have a way to that investors have a way to understand where that sits, but also then, you know, which companies in their portfolios are positioned to act. And so, you know, again, that brings us back to disclosure and transparency being really key in order to allow investors to start to engage their portfolios. And then, you know, a lot of, we've heard a little bit about this, but, you know, for banks, they do a lot of investigation before they're prepared to lend money. So, you know, we've seen some of this from, for example, in Brazil, the big bank BBF has criteria around companies they'll lend to, and many others do as well. So, you know, I think some of that is, you know, sort of distilling and strengthening those criteria and then allowing for direct engagement with those most impactful players.
Thank you very much. Samuel from Kepler Cheuvreux then, turning to you, do you think you're asking the right questions of your portfolio companies and your clients? And the other way back, what do you find frustrating in terms of the transparency and disclosure that you don't get?
Sure. Thank you, Ian. So essentially, in terms of what is probably needed or required and what we are witnessing in the space, so really the question depends on investors, asset class, and sector on the whole. But if we generalize, there are two broad types of action that could perhaps be fostered or accelerated. So the first one is obviously engagement, as highlighted by Tom earlier. And in this respect, we also stress the importance of having a sort of coordination or standardized engagement, which could take place in the context of investors' membership networks, such as the Principles for Responsible Investment, but also some perhaps commodity-specific initiatives, such as the Palm Oil Transparency Toolkit, that is a useful mapping of palm oil producers' data, and that's an initiative in which investors have played a critical role. There is a second type of action that can also be taken, which is actually more on the positive side of the story, which is about allocating capital to projects, primarily in non-listed assets, that help advance sustainable practices, including land restoration projects, for instance. And in this respect, we have also seen an interesting momentum around conservation finance and impact investing and some sort of dedicated impact investing vehicles that try to help advance the fight against deforestation and some of the interrelated challenges, and it also, in my view, helps to highlight the sort of positive role investors can play besides purely the risk mitigation exercise.
Okay, thank you very much, Samuel. Sylvain, turning to you, from your perspective, is there a sense of frustration that you're not able to be the leaders that perhaps you might want to be, or what more do you need from your the organizations that you engage with in your portfolio to help push the agenda forward a bit?
Yeah, that's an interesting and difficult question at the same time. I think the limitation, I think generally speaking, I think there is more and more, at least it's what my personal view, more and more an expectation for banks to sort of filling the gaps that we can see in regulation, in a way that we expect more and more banks to do detailed due diligence on their clients, and I don't dispute that, but I think what I see as well, being inside the bank and discussing with our peers, is that it's also quite difficult to do very detailed due diligence on all our clients, because you know we have basically resource constraints. I mean, in the end, we are commercial banks and not the World Bank. So it's very difficult to actually know what's going on the ground. So I think if we want to be a leader in that field and to do, I think, maybe more than being a leader, but acting really in a responsible manner, I think being able to access information which is quite user friendly on how our clients are operating on the ground is quite critical. So we clearly look at the different initiatives out there that provide information. So the Palm Oil Transparency Toolkit that Samuel mentioned is one of these tools. There are, and it's quite very positive, to more and more effort being done by different NGOs and initiatives on mapping supply chain, on mapping deforestation risk. So that's quite helpful, because otherwise we just can see what the client is publishing, what the client is telling us, and then on the other side, what NGOs are saying. And sometimes we have to some difficulties to find where the truth and where the facts on the ground. So
great. Thank you very much. I think it's a good time to bring in another question from our audience. Quite a straightforward question. Our questioner asks, what are the most useful metrics for measuring forest risk, and how can they be transformed into a financial figure which can be shared? Fiona, perhaps you might like to comment on that. What do you find most useful for measuring forest risk, and how do you transform that into a number?
That's a really difficult question for us, to be honest, because we're so, so far away. I mean, we think that the work that has been done by WRI and that broader transparency coalition looking at using satellite data and LIDAR data to really understand forest change and conversion on the ground is absolutely fascinating. But again, we would look to other parties to really implement that. And the second half of that conversation around how you would transfer that into a number, I don't know, and I'd be delighted if anyone could share that with me, because that actually is one of our challenges. So I look forward to what the others have to contribute to that, to see if it can help me out a bit in the future.
Tom, can you help figure it out?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think what's clear is that we need a better understanding of how companies are actually implementing their commitments. And kind of as a pitch to end things, I think we can't currently link actors to impacts on the ground, but what we are beginning to be able to do is link actors to places. And GCP and the Stockholm Environment Initiative have recently launched Transparency for Sustainable Economies, which is Trace.Earth, which begins to link actors back to places and enables us to begin to overlay impacts in those places as well. And for the first time, it begins to see how commitments map out onto the ground and begin to answer questions such as how are companies implementing their commitments, are commitments an effective intervention to address deforestation? And really begins to get to the point where we can look at whole portfolios of companies, see where they're sourcing their goods from. So begin to answer many of the questions that the other participants were asking.
Thank you, Tom. Gillian, what about your comments on that? What are the most useful metrics that you see for measuring forest risk?
Yeah, I mean, we really see forest risk as business risk, so, one of the things we ask companies is when they respond to the CDP forest request is how much of their revenue is dependent on each of the four forest risk commodities. And so companies will estimate what percentage of their total revenues depend on timber products or palm oil. And that's where we come up with that $906 billion figure as the revenue at risk related related to deforestation. So, you know, that's another way to look at it, is what is the risk to businesses if they don't manage to secure a sustainable source of that product into the future? And that's really quite a staggering number.
Sure. Samuel, turning to you, just very quickly as we're running out of time, what are the most useful metrics that you see for measuring these risks?
Just perhaps as an element of context, it's always useful to better understand how the cost of goods sold break down and what are the key commodities' respective share, and as well to get a better understanding of the revenues that are the most exposed, and including the portion of certified revenues, even if that's imperfect, that's still a useful basis.
Thank you very much. And Sylvain, turning to you then, from your perspective, the most useful metrics for measuring forest risk.
Well, I think what can be useful is to look at some kind of looking at satellite imagery, maybe looking at deforestation rates within concessions or around concessions, things like that. I think we are not really looking at this, the environmental risk, and not really to the financial impacts of it. So, I mean, at least in my team.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to bring things to a close there. Thank you very much, Evan, for all your questions. I'm sorry we didn't get to answer all of them. I would like to thank our panel for their time and insight very much. I think we've had a fascinating discussion in the past hour. Once again, if you would like to continue the debate on business and deforestation, then do join us in Washington in April. We'll send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. And watch out for more insight and analysis from Innovation Forum on this and other topics, and we'll be in touch. We always welcome feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us with follow-up questions and comments. For now, I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much for listening.